I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Move, a podcast which is hosted by me, Jamie Lang, and my business partner, Ed Williams. Now, in 2012, Ed and I founded our confectionery business, Candy Kittens, a business which I'd actually dreamed of having ever since I was 6 years old. And honestly, we wouldn't have achieved half of what we've been able to without all the amazing tips and advice we picked up along the way. Move stands for Motivation, Opportunity, Vision, Entrepreneurship. And each episode of the podcast, we're bringing you the stories of founders, innovative thinkers, entrepreneurs and winners who show us all what's possible with hard work and focus. So whatever you're moving towards, we hope today's guests will open your eyes to what you can achieve. This is Move. Today's guest launched Suitcase Magazine while at university in New York City at 22 years old. She wanted to launch it to fill a gap for how people are traveling today, looking for experiences and find a deeper way to connect to places. Now, she has won various accolades during her time at Suitcase, including 25 under 25 most influential Londoners for the Evening Standard, 30 under 30 by Forbes, Women of the Future Awards, Stevie Awards, and last year, Great British Entrepreneur of the Year Award. Now, a couple of years ago, she co-founded #CookForSyria, an aid for UNICEF that used food to connect people to the Syrian crisis and raise funds for children in the area. She has launched two best-selling cookbooks and raised over $750,000 for UNICEF to date.
Wow.
Say that again, buddy.
Wow.
One more time.
Wow.
That's it, right? When you hear something like that, when you have an intro like that to our next guest, you really sit back and think, what have I actually done?
What have we been doing? We've been wasting a lot of time. She's been pretty busy. We've known her now for what, 7 years, I think.
Mm-hmm.
We met her probably first at our first ever pop-up shop, which is a little bit of a throwback.
It is a throwback. She's an incredible lady, incredible guest. Very excited for this one. Here she is, Serene again, founder of Suitcase Magazine. Serena, how are you?
Oh, I'm good. It's been a while.
It's been a while.
We launched our businesses around the same time.
Yeah, we were saying this earlier. So it was like, what's that, 2012?
2012, yeah. I remember I came, I think, did you come to my launch?
Yeah, I think we did.
I came to your launch.
Covent Garden.
No, our launch was in Shoreditch. Shoreditch House.
Okay.
That's way cooler.
Yeah.
But you had a pop-up in
Yeah, we had a pop-up Neil in Street. Covent Garden. So it's, I launched the first magazine in 2012, in the summer of 2012, and then decided I need to do something to get the word out there more. And it was the London Olympics, so we decided to do a pop-up shop in Covent Garden and Seven Dials.
Yeah,
so that's the one you probably came to.
Yeah.
Do you know what's so interesting about that? We all started our business around the same time. We were around 22 years old. I think that's what we were.
Yeah.
But with you, I kind of was quite lucky because I launched a business with Ed, who kind of was the complete different sort of person to what I was. You know, I was slightly all over the place and slightly, oh my God, let's put something on the moon and open it. And Ed was like, no, let's bring it down to earth a little bit. How did you find, because you were by yourself.
I actually originally had a co-founder.
Sure.
who was very creative, and then I was more the business editorial brains. And then after our launch, we actually ended up having so many people get excited about the idea and offer to help that it was just incredible. Because the first year was just a lot of me Googling like how to start a magazine. I really didn't know what I was doing. And I think one of the most amazing things that I did was one night at like midnight, I decided I was going to email Anna Harvey, who was the VP of Condé Nast at the time. And I just sent her an email saying, you know, I'm going to launch this travel magazine. What do you think? And like, please can you help me with these three things? One was advertising and I can't remember what else. And then she ended up emailing me back saying, like, I love this idea.
Amazing.
Let me help you. You can use me as a reference for anything, which is obviously golden ticket.
Yeah, incredible.
But Sweeney, if I take a step back from that, how did you just go and email her out of the blue? Like, how did it, so you just basically found the email address and was like, here we go.
Yeah, I found her email address and then just cold emailed her. So it must have been a pretty good email.
but that's
what do you write in an email like that?
Did you have blackmail or something?
It's got these photos of you.
But that's what's so incredible that this is what it takes to be someone who to start something. It's about taking those risks and about not really caring about the rejection. And I think that's what a lot of people fear a lot of the time is when they want to start something, want to do something, they fear the rejection. But you didn't fear that.
No, I didn't fear rejection. I suppose I was just quite naive and I was so excited about the idea. It didn't occur to me that it was a bad one. And I guess if you do have a good idea, then it's amazing to see how people will rally around it. And I've seen that with my friends' businesses as well. And another thing that I learned actually is not to try and keep everything to yourself. Because in the beginning, the very beginning, I was like, oh my God, I can't tell anybody about Suitcase because they might just try and copy it. But that it takes a lot of effort to try and actually copy a whole concept. So I think that as soon as I realized that, I started telling more people and it was amazing how many people actually came to help.
And that's what we sort of figured out ourselves and from speaking to a lot of different people. Ed and I always say, talk about your idea. And a lot of people who have started brands or have businesses now say that further down the line. Say, no, talk to everyone about it. Because to copy a concept is pretty hard.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you were already going, yes, your idea was unique. Yes, it was great. But starting a magazine was not an original idea. That had already happened.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, but someone to... You know, you can say an idea, but then to fully copy what you're trying to do is very hard unless you're creating cement for the first time. You know what I mean? Then you're like, oh, naturally.
Quite a weird analogy.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I heard that one of my brother's friends supposedly created some form of cement and then it was taken as his thesis at Oxford.
Right.
Don't know if it's true, but he told me it was.
That's probably a lot smarter than all of us.
Yeah. So talking of Oxford, let's go back to kind of early days for you, Serena. Mm-hmm. Where did you... Sort of, what was the journey that led to Suitcase?
Well, definitely was not Oxford.
Yeah.
So I took a year off after school, which I was lucky enough to do. And I think that was an incredible experience because it allowed me to travel, to work, to get a better idea of actually what I wanted to do when I got to university. And then when I was at school, I was obsessed with this idea of going to Oxford or Cambridge. For me, it was Oxford because my teachers told me that basically, I had the potential to go there. And if I didn't really go there, then, you know, my career would be second rate.
Yeah.
So I applied to Oxford, which if any of you have ever tried that, it is a lot of extra work and a lot of extra stress. And I didn't get in and I was just heartbroken. And then they actually pushed me to try again. And that took so much extra time. And then I had to put myself through the process again. And when I didn't get in the second time, I was like, oh my God, something is wrong with me. There's no hope.
But weirdly enough, if I was going to focus on that point, we talked about the idea of rejection. And you were kind of rejected by Oxford, right? Mm. And that did throw you. And that did sort of put you in a situation where you're like, actually, no, I don't really like the feeling of being rejected. Because what I assume, right, is that if you were applying for Oxford and things like that, you'd always were achieving what you wanted to achieve, right? You're probably a top student, you're doing very, very well at school. And then so to be put down, did that make you feel that you were second rate and you weren't going to achieve what you wanted to achieve?
Yeah, well, I think also at school, you're taught that you can only have certain kinds of career paths, which are very traditional. I mean, I'm sure no one told you that you could be a TV star, or I don't know how you describe your
entrepreneur. Well, I think the reality TV was not...
We're still trying to tell him
that he can't do it.
Yeah, Insta famous. So.
But it's true, and sorry to cut you off, but what is so interesting, I think what this podcast is about people realising that, because at school what happens is that you're kind of pigeonholed down a certain road and you're told to pass this exam, and if you don't, then potentially you won't achieve success, whatever you define success as. Mm. And I think that's a real issue with the educational system. And if you get rejected and things like that, it becomes hard, right? So you must have found
it
hard.
I found it so hard. And it took me a while to recover. And I think luckily my father had made me apply to some other universities in America as well. He grew up in America and he knew how great the education system is there, because it allows you to be a lot more flexible. So you don't have to go in knowing what you want to do, and you can take lots of different courses on the side. I ended up applying to NYU, and I got in for this degree called Liberal Studies, which is no one in the UK have ever heard of it. I hadn't heard of it, which is basically like literature, philosophy, history of art, mixture of global culture, and then you specialize in something. And just being able to explore lots of different subjects and things made me really realize what I wanted to do, and it gave me the flexibility.
And was it whilst you were at NYU that that's where the kind of suitcase idea came
from? Yeah, so the suitcase idea came from the fact that I actually had to study abroad to go to NYU. So I went to Paris, and I went to New York as well. And when I was living in those cities, it was the first time I really needed to rely on, you know, traditional travel websites, without naming any names. And I realized how poorly researched they were, how hard to use they were, and just how ugly they were as well. And so I ended up using a few local blogs and things, but it was just such a nightmare. And I thought, how amazing would it be if I could create one source for travel that was relevant to how younger people are traveling today? So more experience driven and more beautiful. Yeah. To actually use photography.
And was it always going to be a magazine? Was that kind of always the vision?
I always wanted to create a curated platform. And at the time when we launched a print magazine, a quarterly print magazine made the most sense, because it had the most emphasis on curation and I had the most control of how it looked like. Because even 7 years ago, websites were so expensive to make. There was no way I could achieve the same thing. And then now...
And how much back then were you being quoted? What kind of things were you looking at for a website?
Oh, like £100,000 to achieve what I wanted to achieve. I mean, I'm sure I could have spent like 25,000, but I didn't have that money.
But still, £25,000.
I didn't have that money throw out a website. Whereas a magazine, it was, I got offered much more flexible payment terms with my printers. And then that allowed me to make the money back from sales and then from our first pop-up shop as well.
So how quickly from having that initial kind of idea when you're in Paris to then the first print? What were the steps in between that?
8 months.
And what did you have to do? How did you get started?
So first was, I guess, got everything. I don't know. We didn't do it in a very logical way because I never studied branding or anything like that. I suppose first thing was defining who our audience was. So looking at who we were catering to. So we did a survey of our potential audience, like about 500 people, seeing where they were traveling to, how much they were spending, you know, what things they read and what was missing from the travel sources that existed. And then use that information to pull together travel content that made sense for our first issue.
Awesome. Yeah, but what's so interesting is that there are two things here which I find interesting is that, you know, you didn't get into Oxford and you then went to New York and Paris, and that's why we look at everything happens for a reason in that sort of cheesy saying. If you hadn't have traveled to those places and you hadn't have experienced those situations going on where the websites were bad and things like that, Suitcase Magazine never might have existed.
No way.
No way, right? Which is incredible. But also you're 22 years old, you're in a foreign city, and as you've quoted, you started Suitcase Magazine at NYU in your bedroom.
Yeah.
And at 22 years old, I was wearing a pink boiler suit on a beach in Ibiza. I had no idea.
Couple times now.
I know. I don't know
weird
why.
Images that
I don't know why
there.
I keep resorting.
Why a pink boiler suit?
I just remember this one time I was wearing it. But what gave you? Where did that drive and that passion come from? Why did you? Did you always know that you wanted to do something yourself?
No, I think I always knew. I always had ideas, but I never actually did any of them. I always thought, oh, it would be cool to start a travel magazine, but I'm going to do that when I'm older. In my head, I thought 30, which I'm. Well, next year I'm 30. Yeah. So, and then I was going down so many different routes. I didn't know what I really wanted to do. Maybe thinking about screenwriting, publishing, whatever. And then when I actually lived in New York for a bit, I don't know if either of you lived in New York before, but people are so driven.
You just get that from being there for a couple of days, I think.
But I think in what New York does is it sort of, for some reason, it offers opportunity,
which really does.
I think London sometimes lacks.
I think that the hustle, I mean, that I feel like that word was just a New York word, really.
Well, everyone's like hustling.
The whole thing is just a hustle.
I think, and what was interesting for me was I'd never been introduced to that idea that you could be studying and meanwhile be starting a business. Like some people in my year, you know, had separate career, maybe they're an actor or they started a fashion brand or just all these different things. And I'd never come across that before, because all my friends in England were just kind of going down one path rather than trialing different things. So I think you could definitely adopt that mentality and have it in somewhere like London. But it was the first time I'd been exposed to it. And so when I was meeting all these people, and then I was becoming friends with them, and they all had these side hustles that were just so cool, I felt like I needed to do something too. Yeah, so it didn't seem like such a big deal to start a magazine.
But I find it interesting is that Ed and I started a sweets company, and finding out how to sell sweets and things like that was tricky enough. Mm. You know, starting a magazine, right? You know, every single page is a new product that you're selling, pretty much. Every single page. And how many pages you have in a magazine? Well, we got your one right next to us, and you've gotten this one, you know, over 150 pages. We sell a product, right? We sell a suite to supermarkets, things like that, and make it as pretty and as amazing as possible. You have to make over 155 pages look as pretty and as amazing and as beautiful as possible.
Yeah.
And I think that is I would find a lot of pressure, especially at 22 years old, to achieve. And so how do you achieve that?
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I suppose I was just trying to do the best that I could do. And I was reading. I think the first thing I did was also look at all my competitors and read all the magazines, looked at all of their websites, and tore apart what I liked, what I didn't like. And then I had this pile of things that I liked, and then off the back of that, started to just commission friends that I knew could write or take photos. NYU is quite an artistic school, so there wasn't a shortage there. And I also put up on my Facebook, my cover photo, I put Suitcase Magazine. I got 50 of my friends to do the same before the launch. And that created this kind of ripple effect, like, oh, what's Suitcase? And that got the word out there. So yeah. Then we ended up getting quite a lot of it. What I thought at the time was really good contributions. Now I look back at it, I'm like, oh my God, I can't even look at this. But
it has to start somewhere, right?
Yeah.
And how would you describe Suitcase now in your words? What is Suitcase?
So we're a travel media company for an experience driven, let me say this again. We're a travel media company for an experience driven generation of travelers. And so I don't want to limit us to one platform. Like, we have a website, we've got our print magazine. Who knows, in 5 years' time, like, maybe audio will become even bigger. We'll have a whole series of podcasts. Yeah. So I think just reaching people at the right point in their journey and with relevant content.
And that experience part is just so important these days, isn't it? I was actually having a chat with my fiance's dad on the weekend, who's a music producer, and was talking about how album sales now have completely flipped just to the tours and kind of live gigs, which is kind of almost going back in time, but everybody's looking for that experience. And I know at Candy Kittens, for us, it's all about the pop-ups and events that we do, that's kind of really what gives the brand life.
Yeah.
And I also think, even more in terms of experience, I found when we started our business, and I want to find out with you, is that you're 22 years old, and you're a woman, you know, which I think, you know, we spoke about this before in other podcasts, that, you know, something like 2% of women actually get funding for their businesses, which is just unbelievable. Like, what is that statistic? So how did you find, firstly, being so young and being accepted as someone that actually was making something good? And how did you go about funding?
So in the beginning, I took a loan out from my father, which I just repaid recently with my fundraising round, which I'm very proud of.
Yeah, congratulations.
But
can we ask how much that was? Or was that too deep?
I prefer not to say on the podcast.
Yeah, fair enough. That's our first rejection so far.
But I think there's no shame if there's someone near to you, like friend or family, that is willing to give you a cheap loan to start your business. That's maybe an even better option than looking at getting official funding, because I found being young, it was hard enough to have my idea taken seriously. I think maybe nowadays there are more young entrepreneurs, so maybe you'd get taken more seriously. But I found being young a bigger barrier than being a woman. I find that the challenge is similar, that I found that people at the time couldn't take what I was doing that seriously, because they thought I was at university, and how could I know anything about media, because I'd never worked in media before. I'd never worked in travel before. So yeah, that's a nice little project.
So you were finding it tricky to be accepted and for people to take you seriously, because it kind of was like a hobby and things like that. And you had this loan from your father and you were doing these. When did you start to, and how did you know how to start getting revenue and actually start making money from the magazine?
So that was always a goal. If I hadn't had that in mind, then it would have just been literally a project, which it never was. So I knew that I was going to get money from my magazine sales. And that's also why I did a pop-up so soon after launching, because I'm sure you know that pop-ups, if you do them right, are amazing marketing tools. You can talk to people as well. Like, I can see what my readers like about the magazine, what they don't like. And it's a great engagement tool. But then it's also just good because we were selling the magazine. We were also selling things from all around the world that we featured in the magazine. So it was a nice showcase. But then we also just made money from that. And in the first 4 years, we probably did about 6 pop-ups. Because then during that time, we then grew our magazine circulation.
Were they all in London? Or?
Yeah, all in London. Yep. And we did a few parties in the States as well, during Art Basel, Miami. So wherever our audience might be. But during
the
that
magazine
time,
is on sale around the world, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yep. Mm-hmm. But we wanted to let our magazine circulation grow. And then the advertising came a lot more easily, rather than saying, hey, we've got 5,000 issues.
And who was the first advertiser?
Our first advertiser was, I think it was Estee Lauder, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because you've worked with some pretty epic brands now.
Yeah. Rolex. Yeah.
Did you ever find this? Because I suppose you find this in lots of different places, that you're creating a magazine that people love to read, and they love it and they experience it and all those kind of things. And as soon as you start putting ads in it, do your readers suddenly go, hang on, you're making money off the back of us? Or do they not notice that or care?
Well, I think our readers know that we need to make money somehow. And if we're making money via advertising, then we're kind of being less abusive towards our readers in some ways, because we're not asking them for more. And we only work with brands that our readers would probably like or wear or choose to buy. So then it's not as an intrusive experience. We do a lot of native content, which means advertising that looks more like written content. And we did this amazing partnership, for example, with American Express, where we did a series of road trips, and that was some of our most popular content on our website, naturally, because everyone's doing a road trip.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But what also is there is the fact that I've seen you sort of say from the beginning that you wanted to keep very much the business yourself, and you didn't want anyone really else to have it. Wasn't that right? That you wanted to not give away too much equity and things like that?
Yeah, well, then I changed my mind. we actually did our first investment round last year.
Yeah, but this is what's so amazing. You are, okay, you're 7 years in, isn't it?
Yeah.
So after 7 years or 6, 7 years, you suddenly then go for investment. And normally what happens in these situations, you know, like Ed and I and other people, you build a little bit and then you go for investment straight away. And it's kind of, you know, a process as you go along. You know, I also was very naive towards equity.
Yeah.
And at the beginning of what a lot of people building a business don't realize is that equity is cheap. So you can give it away at the beginning, but you can never get it back.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably one of the biggest mistakes that I had to learn, is that once you give away equity, you can't get it back. Who was your mentor and who taught you that? Or did you just know that yourself?
It was more of a feeling. I think I was actually a little bit too selfish with my company. I didn't think of investors as being a potential asset. Because if you have the right investors, then they can actually help you grow your business. So say I'd found someone who was a media mogul and someone who was, you know, I don't know, CEO of a big travel company, then they could have opened so many doors for me early on. But I was really concerned with the brand image and like the products and someone coming in and changing everything. But realistically, if an investor has a small amount, they can't do that.
Yeah, of course. And then it's about what else they can bring to the party other than money.
When I actually raised money, I did do it from angel investors, so individuals, rather than a VC, so a company or a group of people, because I actually then could hand pick who I had invested in the company, and that meant that I chose people that could help me.
And I think that's super important. It's kind of similar to what Jamie and I have done at Candy Kittens. And what were you looking for then when you kind of picked those people? Was it about, like you say, bringing people in that brought relevant experience?
Yeah, so I think the first thing was that they needed to be really passionate about the business. We actually also brought in two female investors, which was really important to me because our product is read by almost about 60% females. And also just there's so few female investors out there and female founders. That's just a nice thing to have. And then I was looking for a mixture of people that are passionate and then also some expertise. So one of our investors is also the chairman of LVMH Asia. So big expertise in luxury products. Amazing.
Yeah, but how did you find these people? Because that's what the tricky thing is. And it's very sort of, I suppose, when you have a brand and you have a business and it's doing well and those kind of things. And so it's easier, I suppose, to get people on board. But you are, what I think you're saying is that you were able to kind of pick and choose in a weird kind of way. So how did you find those contacts and how did you get them?
So I only knew one of them before. I got two of my investors from sending an email out to my database. My
you and your emails just sending them out. Cold email.
Email queen.
Listen, I got some more photos on you, so give it back.
I sent an email out to my database, like a very inspirational one, telling all of our readers what we're planning to do with Suitcase in the future, and saying that we're essentially fundraising, and if anyone was interested, to let me know. And it was amazing, actually, how many people came out of the woodwork. I think we had about over 100 answers.
Wow.
And not everyone could have. I had a minimum investment size so that I wouldn't have too many investors. I wanted to have fewer investors. But there were a lot of people that just wanted to give, you know, a few hundred pounds. So if we ever did a crowdfunding thing, it's a really amazing source of finding potential investors.
For sure.
But then what's tricky is that you were saying at the beginning that you had this idea at 22 years old while setting up, which I still found fascinating, your magazine in your bedroom, pretty much, that you didn't want to give anything away. Yeah. And you're now 7 years later and you've had some ups and downs, as I'm sure, you know, like everyone has had. But you have done two things, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but first you've given away equity, which you didn't want to do, which is letting your business go into other people's hands slightly. Yeah. But also you've changed from being editor-in-chief to just CEO.
Yeah.
And that is giving away even more control to someone, not even more control, but giving someone else the ability to step in your shoes and have a vision that perhaps isn't yours. How do you get past that as someone who is a founder of a business?
Well, I think when I first started, I obviously needed to do everything because I just had a team of about two people. and then as we grew, I was able to bring in people that had expertise in different areas and could really help the magazine grow. And I think when you have someone who's just so talented in your team and they're doing such a good job at something, you just know. I mean, I felt like I just knew at one point that they could do my job in that area better than me. And it was at that point that I decided to promote them. And so I first promoted someone to an editor in chief, and then I became CEO, I think that was 3 years ago. And since then I've also, you know, promoted someone to COO. So I haven't given up control in some ways. Or taking a step back and not chilling. Definitely not chilling.
But you've given confidence to someone else.
Yeah, it's more giving a platform for someone in my team to go and just run and do that, run that area of the business as well as they can. So I know I'm not very good at numbers or operations, so my COO is really good at that. So then it's great for her to be able to have that, and then I can focus on more what I'm good at.
And how have you found that process of building the team that you needed?
I mean, it was definitely difficult. I think I made a mistake quite a few mistakes.
And go on these idea of mistakes. So I think it's key to understand what mistakes we've made.
So I made a mistake of just hiring someone who was just like a really fun guy at one point who had no skill set. And he was also just a bit...
What, he did monkey bars?
Yeah. Like, he didn't have any experience in media, which is fine. But then I hired him in a position where he was going out and representing the magazine. And then it was just really difficult because, he just wouldn't really listen to me. So,
rule one, find somebody who wants to listen.
And then I also overhired. I hired someone who had a lot more experience than me. But then... that meant that it was very difficult for me to manage them. And then it was just a bit of a mess. And she was a really bad culture fit with the team. And when the team is so small, you need to hire someone that is, it is hard to find. You need to hire someone, I think, personality first and then skill set second.
So really what I'm kind of discovering here is that what you're saying is that the biggest skill set you have to learn running the business is actually hiring and managing people.
Yeah,
and that's the biggest thing. So that you had this idea to set up the magazine and have all of those kind of things. But in fact, you then find people who are potentially better at doing things than you, but also realizing what people not to hire as well. And Ed actually speaks about this a lot. And Ed is, our managing director of Candy Kittens. And that's what he had to realize. And in fact, you spend most of your days actually just managing people rather than growing the business. Other people grow the business. You just manage them.
Yeah, I think there's a big transition when you first kind of start out from being that kind of, as you say, doing everything and anything that you just have to do because you haven't got choice, to then delegating and actually becoming a manager rather than a founder. But it's an interesting place to be. And I guess I always say that we didn't ever want to be managers. That's not why we started the business.
Yeah.
But it's just part and parcel of something that you've got to learn
really
to do a good job.
I really relate to that. I think last year when I was fundraising, it was really a huge low point for me because... up until then, even though it was obviously really stressful for whatever reason, whether it's cash flow or, we didn't have enough users or whatever the reason was, there was always, I always had the opportunity to be creative and to travel. Whereas last year, my job was so siloed into going out and meeting people and raising money and looking at numbers all the time, looking at performance metrics. And it was so dry. I got so depressed.
Yeah.
I decided something needed to change.
And, you kind of lose sight of what you actually were doing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I think that then you sort of sit back for a second sometimes and you go, well, what am I actually doing here? Because, you started something which was fun and exciting and everyone had their side hustle, as you said, when you were in New York. And this was your side hustle and then it becomes something else. And then what it becomes is something that actually... damages your own emotions. And so you sort of sit back and go, hang on a second, where is all the passion and the love and the beauty gone into building this thing? And then you have to rethink and find that back again.
Jamie, bad news. That is the end of part one.
What?
I know. We got there so quick, but don't fear. Part two is coming right up, just one click away. So everybody that's listening, just go over and click part two.
Thank you so much for listening. Honestly, it really does mean a huge amount. And we also hope today's podcast has inspired you to move towards your dream or passion. Now, if you like the podcast, please subscribe and leave us a comment. And if you'd like to get in touch, please email us at move@moveclub.co.uk or follow us on Instagram @moveclub. Until next time, this is Move.